The wildlife and its habitat cannot speak, so we must, and we will.
You're listening to the Conservation Federation of Missouri podcast.
Women had a 5-cell D flashlight. That everybody carried those big old flashlights, you know. And he hit this guy in the head, and he knocked him out, and he fell in the water. And we grabbed up his sack of frogs, and I said, "Is every night like this, Vernon?" I said, "Do you kill people every night?" He said, "Well, the next deal I was going to shoot him was my .22." But he, but that was my first night on the job. So we were frogging, and he knocked a guy out with a flashlight. So that's the story.
In 1935, you were 17 years old, and your dad said, "Bill, we're going to go down to this meeting in Columbia. Take it from there."
Well, my dad had a couple of good fishing and hunting partners in Mobley. One was a doctor. One was a Dr. L.A. Nickel, our family physician. He was a duck hunter. And his other friend was O'Connor. He was the leading lawyer in Mobley. They had been attracted to us, some announcements by the inside world regarding the politics of fish and game problems in Missouri. And they had been assigned some committee work and some of this and that. One of these days, they talked to Dad and they said, "We're getting ready to go to Columbia. There's going to be a meeting down there, which we're going to pull together a bunch of people that are interested in changing things in Missouri as far as the world of fish and game and forestry." And they said, "Dad, would you like to go?" Dad wasn't on a committee, but he was a geographer. They called him a conservation geographer. He was teaching conservation geography in 1920s, and nobody did that. So Dad was a very special scientist. He was a great mentor for me. I was an only child. So Dad says, "Well, Bill, I'm going down to Columbia for this meeting at the Tiger Hotel. Would you like to go with me?" Just about everywhere he went, if it was attractive, he would take me with him. So I went, I got in a car and went down to Columbia. And so Dr. Nickel and O'Connor, the lawyer, they were there too. They were part of a statewide committee. Now remember, later on, I lived in Columbia a long time. And I also went to school at the University of Missouri. So, and my wife and all my four kids, and we're University of Missouri people, but... And it was so neat because the university didn't have many places to meet. And the Tiger Hotel was it. Well, there was the Daniel Boone Tavern, which was a hotel. But the Tiger had the reputation. So we ended up going to the Tiger Hotel for that day. And that's where the story started.
So the culmination of that day was the formation of the Conservation Federation of Missouri.
And yeah, they had a great wide variety of people. I am absolutely amazed at the talent that they were able to assemble for that meeting. A great cut clear across the citizens of Missouri, all kinds of people. Essentially, I think it all started with the duck hunters and the group in St. Louis. They were the ones who got all that started. And then they started looking for outsiders, writers and other people that would come to Missouri and help them. And most all those people said, "You do your own work. You don't need a paid people to come in from outside and try to sell Missourians on something. They need to do it themselves." And of course, out of all this arises the story of Sidney Stevens and Rudolph Bennett. And that's the reason that thing really got started. Sid Stevens was the son of Edward Stevens and all that Stevens bunch that formed the early days of the Stevens College. Actually, Edward Stevens was on the building committee to build the state capitol, so he was a leader too. But Sid was a very well-educated printer and publisher. He went to Harvard. He was there about the same time that Franklin Roosevelt was there. And it turned out that Rudolph Bennett had been to Harvard. Rudolph was a teacher that had come out of the New England area. He went to Harvard. He became an invertebrate professor, and he was great on birds, and he began to get infatuated, just absolutely infatuated with the idea of conservation. And of course, this was the same time that Aldo Leopold was beginning to surface from the West, where he was dealing with the deer and the forestry of the West, and then he migrated up to Wisconsin and so forth. So in this process, I'll jump here just a little bit. Aldo Leopold had his brother, the family owned a furniture company in Iowa, and they mailed one piece of furniture called the Leopold Desk. In that time of the world, everybody who owned a piece of furniture, but it was good, they owned a Leopold Desk. This is the family. But early on, one of the brothers used to go down to Missouri to float the Current River. And not the rest of the family didn't do that. So a couple, three times, he took Aldo Leopold down there, and they had a good time in the Ozarks. It was really primitive at that time. Well, anyway, out of all that came, later on, as Aldo Leopold moved into the Midwest and landed in Wisconsin, Madison, he also decided he'd write the story of the Ozarks and its resources, wildlife and fisheries and so forth. And in doing this, he got the help of ammunition, gun makers and so forth and so on. And he wrote a very interesting book about the early days of the Ozarks and so forth. And that book was the start of the thoughts of what could have happened in Missouri. And about the same time, Rudolph Bennett had been invited to be a professor at the University of Missouri. And so these two found soulmates. Rudolph wanted to have a good program at Missouri. Sid Stevens, he was a duck hunter and a quail hunter, but he was really kind of tired of talking to people. They talked like they were barbershop experts. He said, you know, I come from a background where you deal with facts. And the facts, what he was really saying, eventually ended up as the science of wildlife management. That's what he was alluring. There wasn't any such stuff at that time. But Rudolph was trying to establish this program at the University of Missouri. So in all this, the period of the Leopolds, the fact that he wrote this book in the 20s, and then Rudolph Bennett had emerged coming from the Northeast, the United States, and with the Harvard background, and then all of a sudden we have this Sidney Stevens. This is a threesome, as far as I'm concerned, that were the idea of doing something about the terrible situation in the resource area, fish, game, and forestry.
So, of course, if you haven't figured it out yet, I'm sitting down with Bill Crawford. Bill is a huge legend to conservation here in Missouri. We're preparing to celebrate his 99th birthday, August 30th. It's just my honor, Bill, to be here with you and to discuss some of this history. I'm going to reel you back in to that founding meeting, though. Okay. So, because you're the only person who can tell us about what happened that day. You get down there with your dad. You get into the Tiger Hotel.
Okay.
We know you were in that ballroom on the second floor, back in the back.
Okay.
What does the room look like? You take your seats, and who starts leading the meeting off the bat?
Yeah. That was the neatest ballroom in Columbia. The university had very few meeting places. There weren't any places. It had the best floor. It was a really neat place. And over history time, the time of history, it's amazing that the Federation type of thing developed at the Tiger Hotel, because so many other things developed there too. So at that meeting, Sid dominated the thing. They had said, the group that were working on this problem, they said, well, we need to get somebody who's an expert on organizations and so forth. And they just kept rolling this subject around and around and around. And they just kept getting back to Sid Stevens. And Sid finally bit the bullet and took their challenge and then became the head of this. It's remarkable because he was a bulldog. He was smooth, a neat guy. He was had a personality that everybody loved, but he demanded that they talk about facts, and facts meant the scientific approach to handling a resource. And Missouri was a perfect example of going the other way. We were a state that had a lot of resources, but had been badly handled over the years, and the legislature used it as a political tool. Every 3 or 4 years, everything in that outfit would change. Forestry was kind of sitting out there by itself. Of course, forestry, Missouri was the last remaining big forest in the United States, in the Midwest, standing. They had already butchered all the stuff out east and north, and they had Indiana, Illinois, all that beautiful forest had basically been cut down, but there was a big forest left in Missouri. It wasn't a good forest. It was toward the dry side of the plains, and they got it cheap. So the lumber industry came in and eventually wiped out the Ozark area and the Boot Heel. And in that process, they left a lot of land that was very bad because it did not have a good soil. It was very rocky. The water situation, except for the rivers, was not very good. So about half of Missouri in the Ozark to the south was in a very, very precarious situation. In fact, they were selling some of that land for 50 cents an acre. And yet here was millions of acres of this stuff laying down there south of the Missouri River. There was this problem, and then the other side of the problem was prairies. Prairies were the unplowed tall grass prairies that had been there for eons of time, and they were not being used right, and eventually the eastern farming community took over, made row crops out of them, and of course that left a big void in the resource deal. So the story of what Missouri needed was tremendous. It was a state that was pretty much laid waste at that time. But in the process, the fish and game process was, it had been a kind of a frontier type of a thing. You used it for food, you used it for this, you used it for commercial hunting, you used it for feeding the people in St. Louis and Chicago and so forth. Missouri was kind of a hellhole of a place. They were working on the last remnants of the wild populations. They were commercial fishing everything they could. They had decimated the forest, and the prairies were on their way. So Missouri was at a crossroads, and yet their legislature did not see any of this.
When you arrived, can you recall if there was a sign-in sheet? Do you know if anybody passed around a paper to collect who was there?
I have. That question has come up many times. I don't know of any.
Yeah, that's a tragedy that we don't know.
It's a tragedy. I might have not signed it because I wasn't official. I was just an observer. I was just there.
When you say official, was this an invitation-only event?
It was official to the people that had been assigned committees, but they were also bringing in friends. So,
was the state represented as a whole? Were there people from the Ozarks?
They represented counties as a rule, counties. And in Missouri, in the county I was in was Randall. It was a very, very political county, but they had Mobley was a great, great town at that time. It had 1,800 people working for the Wabash Railroad. And it was a very elegant community. And they had lots of money, and there were a lot of sportsmen involved in that railroad group. And so out of that group was a very, very strong legal community in Mobley. And there was also a good medical. They had three hospitals there. The Wabash had one of their main hospitals in the United States in Mobley when the Wabash was in that area. So Mobley was a pretty much of a prized town. And that's the area that I came out of. So as far as the signing up a sign sheet, and of course, I forget the name, was who was our biological. Who signed the picture that I got?
Ding Darling. The Ding Darling sketch?
The Ding Darling picture. Ding Darling was at the table that I sat at. And along with him was the publisher of the Tribune. That family was there. And the meeting, everybody just spoke their piece. And what they were really trying to do was trying to find, do we want a leader here? And what did we want the leader to do? And what needed to be done? How were we going to do it? And so forth and so on. It was what I would call a grassroots meeting. They weren't really prepared at that time to have a complete committee assignment of all the officers and so forth. It was an exploratory meeting, as far as I remember.
So to capitalize on that story a little bit, for those that may not be aware, Ding Darling attended this meeting in 1935.
Yeah.
He later went on to create the National Wildlife Federation.
That's right.
He created the duck stamp.
That's
and he was in this meeting, and he must have got... His mind must have wandered a little bit because he sat down with a pencil and on a paper tablecloth drew this sketch.
I suspect he was a little bit bored.
Yeah, and Hank Waters tore that sketch off that tablecloth.
Hank Waters' daddy.
Yeah, senior.
Yeah.
And you can even see the ring where Ding had his coffee cup sitting.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, now there's the Ding Darling National Wildlife Refuge down on Sanibel Island in Florida. So he must have taken a lot of inspiration from that meeting and from Missouri.
He was a powerhouse. The story about Ding Darling, he was an Iowa boy. He got his reputation as being a political cartoonist. Then he hit the national scene about the same time that... Franklin Roosevelt had the reputation of being interested in conservation at all. He was a politician, and he knew what he liked to do. But the word that I got, and in all the things that have happened since, that Ding Darling was the one who turned Franklin Roosevelt around to the point that that he would not oppose legislation like the Pittman-Robertson bills and all the bills that came through Congress at that period of time, that they said Ding Darling was the powerhouse that got Franklin Roosevelt to do to put his stamp on it. So that story, you don't hear that story very much, but that's what I get from my observations over time.
Now, Nash Buckingham came into the picture.
He sure did. And Nash Buckingham was a Tennessee boy, and they had called him early on. I think the duck hunters in the St. Louis area had contacted him and asked him if he would come up and give them some advice. He came up, and they were thinking that maybe he would be a leader for the movement, rather than, say, Sid Stevens or something. And he quickly told them, you need a local boy. You need somebody who can speak to Missourians, to their problems, and to this and to that. And so he advised the Missourians at that time, and he was an excellent writer, super writer. He met with them. I don't know the dates in which he met them, but he met with them and told them, you don't need me. You don't need me. You need a guy like Sid Stevens. And Sid Stevens was being coached in all this, how to fit the political public to a way of looking at fishing game and forestry as a science rather than as a barbershop approach. So that's what the Nash Buckingham got in there and did. And his advice was very, very good. Of course, you didn't need to go out and hire a guy in Tennessee to come up and tell Missourians. Missourians, you know, they're noted for being pretty obstinate and pretty ornery and pretty argumentative. So, and that's right, they always have been. But he said, you need your local boy. And Sid Stevens was really a great spokesman. Of course, he had the contacts. Sid Stevens later on became a WPA administrator for Missouri, which was one of Franklin Roosevelt's main programs, and CCC and all that kind of stuff. But I think Sid Stevens is then you get the effect of the professor Rudolph Bennett trying to develop the program at Missouri, and he really coached Sid Stevens. He coached him, and they began to develop this very close relationship. And involved in this was, of course, way far up, and Madison was the our famous guys. And so it was I guess it wasn't done by a plan. It fell into place pretty much, the how these guys. And of course, anybody who studies the period of 30s of the 30s realize that most everything that happened in the wildlife resource world and forestry and a lot of these other conservation stories got its real basis in the 30s. Of course, there was the effect of Theodore Roosevelt, who had early thoughts on how to put together national parks and all kinds of things. And he was a tremendous influence. But that influence lasted as when he was around. Then it kind of died out and then came back in the 30s. And he was a great writer. He wrote a lot. A lot of books written by, or maybe he had a ghostwriter, I don't know. But he did a lot of writing that for a president. I don't know how he did it.
I don't think he was having a ghostwriter. I think those were really Teddy's words.
Okay.
That's just, I hope so.
But anyway.
I believe so.
Okay. Well, so anyway, so this period of the 30s, Missourians were not alone. There were things going on nationally in the national forest problems and so forth and so on. Governor Pinchot of Pennsylvania and so forth. So things were happening all over, but Missouri was looking for a new approach. And the new approach was, how do you remove all this from the state of everyday politics? And so the story starts developing there, and that was the reason. And of course, the Missourians hit upon the idea of a petition through the Constitution and all that. And that set Missouri so far ahead of anybody else. Nobody even thought about including this resource problem into constitutions. They just didn't think about that at all. So this approach was so different, and that's what that thing got. It happened there in the Tiger. It was a pulling together of ideas. Remember, Missouri is a very funny state. They're tied to 7 or 8 states on the side. And where are the populations in Missouri? You go St. Louis, St. Genevieve, Springfield, Joplin, Kansas City, St. Joe, Hannibal, and all the way around. The population in Missouri was on the edge. And all these edges also traded and worked with the adjacent states. You go down Cape Girardeau, half the people shop in Memphis. You go to Hannibal and everybody shops in Quincy. You go to St. Joe and everybody goes to Topeka. So Missouri, I've often wondered how Missouri ever governed. And now I think today, the government of Missouri is very complicated because we still have all these populations sitting on the edge. And they sit right next to another state. And don't think we're not affected by Arkansas. A lot of things go on in Arkansas. The Arkansas people talk to Missouri people. Missouri people say, boy, what they're doing in Arkansas is great. Well, it may not be great, but this effect gets into Missouri. Then you turn this into politics. And the political scene in Missouri is very, very complicated, very complicated. So for a guy like Sid Stevens, who knew how to talk to people and to get the political forces together, in Missouri, he was an ideal person for this.
So after this meeting, you're 17 years old at the meeting. You're getting ready for college okay. age.
Yeah.
You decide that you're going to come to the University
well,
of Missouri.
Well, that's a story in itself,
and
too.
And start studying wildlife.
Yeah, that's right. And there was a story of why I came down here. Missouri had an emerging program. It led by Rudolph Bennett. I think he got a lot of that from Aldo Leopold. But there were some established programs at Purdue. There was an established program in Michigan. There were established programs on the East Coast for oceanography. And there was a batch of stuff going on in California. So when they started talking about a program in Missouri, I had a great career in a junior college at Mobley. It was not a state school, and we didn't get any state money. It was run by the local school board, and that's where Mobley Junior College got its start. And I was one of those guys that went there in the first 5 years of that school. They were a pre-professional school. Most everybody there went on to a professional dentistry or medicine or whatever. And I was kind of interested in maybe medicine. Well, anyway, so in the process of this, there were two, three people that affected where I fit in. My dad was the principal of the high school. Each year, you would have these various universities and colleges come to high schools and make talks. And we had one guy, T.E. Musselman. He ran a business school in Quincy. He was an outstanding ornithologist, but he was helping run his dad's business in Quincy, which was educating secretaries. And so this process, he visited Mobley, and Dad had him on a program as assembly. And we also had him at our house for supper that night. And so he became very much involved in getting me started as a naturalist. What he did, he from his business, he'd take the summer off and go down and be a naturalist for big camps in the South, down at the end of the Appalachian Trail, down in that country. So T.E. Musselman was one of those guys. The next people was Esther Adams. She ran a program of zoology and botany, and she was excellent in both. Field biology. And she had gone to the University of Missouri, but she was at the college. And so she, in the process of this going to school there, she invited Sid Stevens and Rudolph Bennett up to make a talk to the Bozo Club. The Bozo Club was a combination club between these two bunches. And so they came up there, and they were just starting to talk about all this problems of how you handle a resource. So my dad said, I told my dad, you know, we're having Mr. Stevens and Rudolph Bennett for a talk out at the college. And Dad said, well, I'm going to come out to that. So he came out there, and they began to talk about their dreams, what was kind of cooking. And so Dad said, well, we'll just have them out for supper. And at supper that night, Rudolph says, Bill, where are you going to go to school? I said, I think I'm going to Purdue. Oh, come on. He said, I got a school that's going to be great down here in Missouri, 30 miles away, and you're going to Purdue?
You know, that's where I went to school.
Huh?
I went to Purdue.
Well, okay, we'll talk about that. But anyway, I had some contacts there. So Rudolph twisted my arm and so forth, and I headed down 30 miles south from Mobley into the university and entered as a junior. And so in those junior years, Rudolph was just pulling his little program together, and one of the first things that happened in that program as a junior, they were starting to organize a 10-state deal for educators in wildlife and fisheries. So, and they were holding one of the first meetings in Madison, and Elder Leopold was behind that. Rudolph says, let's take a bunch of guys out of Jefferson City and get a bunch. So we rolled a bunch of cars and drove to Madison, Wisconsin. The interesting thing about this was my first real meeting with Elder Leopold. We arrived there on a Saturday, not much going on. And Sunday, the big hotel we were in, they had a beautiful eating nightclub, but it wasn't open on Sunday. So Rudolph got up in front of this group, there's about 500 people, and he said, I want to talk to the students that's here. And there wasn't too many, about 35. But it didn't cost us anything. We just rode along with everybody else. So he took over the nightclub and set up on the stage and had these 35 people, and we were there 4 hours. That was my first go-around with him. You could tell he was a dreamer. He was talking about the things that were going on in the world and how we should be closer to nature and how we should be wide awake to see what's happening and what's happening to our resources. So as a junior in college, I got to sit in front of Elder Leopold with that bunch. And that pretty much turned me on, really did. And so we went back home, and Rudolph, Leopold, there weren't many books at that time on the subject. And he had made a book called A Symposium. And Rudolph got a copy of that book, and he carried it back down to Missouri and made his copy of The Symposium. So when we took game management and all those courses with at Missouri, it was pretty much a thing that Aldo Leopold was doing at Wisconsin. So here, it's just things that happen. So that was the start. And in that bunch that went up there was Carl Noren, Charlie Schwartz, a whole bunch of the eventual guys who really made Missouri pretty famous for their program. Out of that program of Rudolph Bennett's, and it was amazing, as the program for the department started, Conservation Commission they called it, Rudolph got the appointment called the official technical advisor for the commission. And so no money, but he was kind of the kingpin of the scientific approach to management of wildlife. And so that's the germ that all that got started at.
So when the commission started, and now I'm just going off of things I read, so I want you to fill in the blanks here. The commission was created through the passage of the initiative petition process to change the Constitution. Did you carry petitions and get signatures for that?
Oh, sure. There were all sorts of political, there were all sorts of ways to do that. Radio was not strong, but it was there, not very much. A lot of this was carried to county political speeches. Every county, remember we had a committee that was associated with counties, so each county got a chance to get up on the platform and talk about this stuff. So what happened, my dad came home one night, and the back end of the, he had a 1929 Chevrolet, and I remember the back seat was all full of stuff. I said, "What you got there, Dad?" He said, I got a batch of stuff I'm supposed to tack up on telephone poles all around Randolph County. And I said, "Well, let's get going." So we'd take our car and start driving the country roads and tacking up this stuff and handing it out to country stores and all that kind of. And also, we came from Howard County, which was Fayette, and we knew all that country. So we'd call the people down there at the county seat at Fayette and ask if we could help them. And they said, "Yeah, you take the north part of the county from Burton up to Higbee and Roanoke and all those places. You take that part of Howard County." So we worked two counties there. And it was a mystery. People didn't know. But they were very unhappy. They didn't know how unhappy they were. They just knew things weren't right. And what was really going, they'd get a pretty good man working a county as a conservation person or a game warden or something. He might be the best in the world. He'd last about 2 years, and then the politician would kick him out, and they'd have somebody else. It was totally political. And so everybody was onto that sort of stuff, and they said, "It's not working. It's just not working." And so I guess we need this other approach. So it was an easy sell. I don't think people understood how important a petition can be. Petitions weren't used very much. They're used a lot now. Everybody wants to take a petition, you know. I have a personal feeling that we have petitions because the legislature won't act. They say, "Well, we can't make a decision. We'll let the people make a decision." So actually, that's what was going on there. They would not correct all the mistakes and all the bad stuff that was going on with that resource problem, and wouldn't do anything about it. We'd let the people decide. Well, they found out about that one. They found out. And so the petition, it passed, and we had the amendment for the creation of the Conservation Commission. And, of course, I hate to say this, but it's the true fact that the legislature has never really liked it. There's a lot of you always get lots of people that approve things, but you also have an element within a legislature that they think they're giving up their powers, they're giving up their their rights to do things, and yet they don't do anything to those things. So it takes organizations, it takes legislation, it takes organizations like the Federation, it takes the country. This Missouri was full of fishing and hunting clubs, but they had no connection to each other. I used to spend a lot of time appearing before hunting and fishing clubs. They didn't belong to anybody, and they were fun to be to, but they were not connected. So along came the Federation. Out of that came a welding of this statewide organization that you have now.
So after it passed, there was a time where there was challenges to the new commission. I believe the legislature
came after the challenges.
They hired I.T. Bodie to be the first director.
Yeah.
They wouldn't appropriate the funds to pay his salary.
Yeah.
So Edward Love had to pay his salary.
Oh, yeah.
What was that like going through?
Well, it was a nightmare. I think the hiring of the right people was very helpful at that time. Remember, this was all happening at the start of the World War II in the 30s. And things were really funny in those days. People were at war. There were other subjects to be talked about. And when the commission was approved through the petition vote and the Constitution changed, there was an amazing number of people available for hire. People that didn't have jobs, people that had the right approach, technical. Arthur L. Clark was, I talk about him an awful lot. He was a commissioner for Connecticut. He was a writer. He was probably one of the more prominent sportsmen in the East Coast at that time. And he was out of the East, and I don't know whether he was a Harvard man or not, but Sidney Stevens knew about him, and Rudolph Bennett knew him. And so when they started to hire people for the new Conservation Commission, they looked to some of this early know-how, and they could not have picked a better person than Arthur L. Clark. He was a mature, he was a good writer, a speaker, and he had the idea that you're not going to do this with public lands. The basis of all the wildlife and forestry problems are basically on private land. And that was exactly what the new commission said. Missouri was a land-poor state as far as public lands. So we need a man who knows how to carry the word from the mission of the commission to the private landowner. Well, where do some of these people come from? The people we began to hire were former Extension Service people, teachers. We were able to hire a whole bunch of people they were not just fresh kids right out of school. They were, well, they could stand up in front of people and talk and do things. Because they were hunters and fishermen. So a lot of the early people that we pulled into the formation of the new department came from that area in the Depression. A lot of these people, honestly, were in the CCC, in the WPA. People didn't have jobs. And so you had a lot of these people, and they were lining up to be. And then the conservation agents, they were no longer picked on political deals. They were picked, and they had to have a high school degree, and soon it wasn't very long until they had to have a university degree of some sort, advanced degree. So the putting together the early days of the Conservation Department was very interesting to see where they found the people to put that in. And interesting enough, among the first four or five people that we hired as biologists, one of them was Starker Leopold. And so Starker he was going to school at Berkeley in California, and he needed a subject matter to study as a part of his requirement. And his dad says, well, they got a nice little turkey flock left down in Missouri, an original stock. Why don't you go down and find out why that works, why that turkey? So Starker came down, and he became a very close friend of ours. And he did his job, and he found the answers and took off for Berkeley and became head of the department there and wrote books and became famous. So we started out, and Harold Terrell was an early biologist with us, most everybody was getting their degrees at Michigan, other places. And so we had a whole bunch of guys that came from other sources. But we were able to hire a lot of people that were experienced. They weren't young people. They were experienced people. Here, off to the side, was Rudolph Bennett sitting as technical advisor. So he was advising these people who would make a good person and who would not make a good person. And Arthur Clark sat on top of that. So Arthur Clark, with all of his experience on the East Coast, they hired him, brought him out here. He didn't last very long, lasted about 6 years.
In what role?
His role was, he was chief of fish, game, and forestry. So he was the number two man under Bodie.
Tell me about Director Bodie.
Mr. Bodie was a professor-type person. He basically was an extension man for Iowa. And so he got all involved in extension work, 4-H and all that kind of stuff. Went to Washington. He worked on the federal level, state level. He was kind of a cold nature, but he had a good mind on him. He was not a good, very, very good public relations person, but technically he's a super person. And he took an awful lot of beating in the early years because they Missourians, the politicians just beat up on him all the time because he wasn't from Missouri. I don't know, there wasn't anything magic about Missourians, but the politicians thought there wasn't anybody in the world that was better than a Missourian, you know. So he came into Missouri and bit the bullet. And then he had other people from out of state. Arthur Clark came from Connecticut. And Starker Leopold is one of the first biologists, came from Wisconsin. And so we got all these people coming from other directions. So he had company. He had company.
What year did you graduate, and what was your first job upon graduation?
Well, I came down to Missouri as a junior and graduated in 1940. At that time, strip mining was really a hot, hot issue. And every stream that was near a strip mining was being badly polluted by sulfuric acid. So Clark called Bennett one day, this was in 1940, said, "What are you going to do with that Crawford guy up there?" "What?" And Rudolph said, "Well, I think he's going to go graduate work with us." Clark said, "What else?" "Well, he's applied to the University of Maryland for an oceanography PhD. So I did. This was an interesting thing in my life. I visited out in Maryland. It was wartime. They were having a hard time finding applications. So here I was, a wildlife man, trying to get a scholarship at the University of Maryland in oceanography. So I went out there, and they liked me. They thought I was a hot dog. So in a later conversation with them, I said, "Now, how much time am I going to have to spend on the ocean in this job?" "Oh, about 65-70%. I said, "Thank you. I'm not going to be on the ocean the rest of my life." So I went back to Missouri and called Arthur Clark, and I said, "I'm ready for a job." And then Arthur Clark called Rudolph Bennett. Bennett says, "He's ready. You're getting a good man." So he hired me. Then so my thesis was on how these acids were working their way from the coal mines into the stream systems and how everything was being affected. It was pretty much limnology. And there wasn't anything being published on that. So I was kind of an early bird on that kind of stuff. So anyway, I took that degree, and it was in fisheries. Well, I've never talked about that very much. Then I got through with that job. That was a job that they paid me $50 a month as a student to do that job. I wrote the thesis and published on it, and it was widely used. In fact, 2 years ago, I got a big, long letter from Australia. Now, remember, this was 1942. I got this letter 2 years ago, and they wanted to know all about me. No, they wanted to know how they got copies of this thesis. And he said, "Who am I talking to?" I said, "You're talking to the author." Can't believe it. They thought they were talking to his son or his grandson. So they were talking to the real guy. So anyway, so I had a a long conversation with the people in Australia. They have lots of strip mining going on there. So that's kind of interesting stuff. I graduated in that stuff. And then I came on board as a, they didn't call us biologists, they called us technicians. Then there's a whole set of organizations that have all kinds of names for people. But we eventually developed that into wildlife biologists. And so I was there. Then I got to, they brought me, they took me to Jefferson City. And I worked with Carl Noren. Carl Noren had been a classmate of mine. And later on, Carl was the director of the department. But he was working on the core problems with the damming up the Osage, the Current River, and all these rivers. The Corps had plans for every river to have dams on it, every river. So that was unacceptable. Missouri made a strong point on that. So I went to work with Carl Noren on that. Then later on, as the biology developed, as the technical side of game management, deer and turkey and all that kind of stuff developed, we had guys scattered everywhere and they weren't coordinated or anything. So they said, Bill, we're going to put you in Columbia and let you develop the staff there. So that's the way that happened. So I was in that staff about 35 years. Probably they were glad to get rid of me.
I don't think so. So what were some of the other jobs you had as you worked your way up the ladder?
They used me for a lot of different things. I was pretty good on my feet, and I became president of the Wildlife Society, a worldwide deal. I had about 25,000 members worldwide at that time. I traveled pretty strong with that bunch. I would say most of what I did was kind of trying to see among administrators, they were dealing with a new field. Wildlife management and fisheries management were in their infancy, and you almost had to fight your way to the table on everything that came up, because they still were trying to do their own thinking without doing the factual part of it. So it was a ticklish time, because you had a commission that was appointed, and they were good people, but they were not particularly knowledgeable. They had their own knowledge, but they, and so it, the business of welding, wildlife management and fisheries management and forestry management into a coordinated state program was just unheard of. And so, but people had to learn to do that. And so I was a pretty good guy to help those things get together. They were always calling me, I had a bunch of the wildlife chiefs and so forth. They said, I just can't get it done up there in a commission meeting. Bill, you come down and see what you can do with them, that kind of stuff. That was kind of some of the things I got into. Then they asked me one time, would I like to be director? And I said, not really, but I was required to apply. And so I applied. And I had a good talk. I kind of got in trouble on that. I thought that with the strong element of the petition drive and the creation of the conservation department within the Constitution gave us a lot of leeway that we weren't using, particularly in the use of non-game, a whole bunch of things. And when I appeared before the commission in my talk about being a director, I talked about things we weren't doing. I wasn't being critical. I was just saying, and they were thinking I was being critical of the present programs. So they kind of pretty much wiped me out on a couple of times. And later on, Carl Noren, he talked with me much about this in the early days about, and that's what he picked up on. And that's how we got the sales tax eventually.
So how did everything change after the sales tax?
Well, drastically, because we had money to do things that needed to be done. We were a state that our fisheries program, we had enormous amount of new water being farmed, those federal lakes, pond programs, lakes everywhere, no personnel to do this stuff with. Just every hurry you turned, you needed something. And then there was a whole natural history program that was developing, the business of naturalists being aware of the trees and forests and the frogs and the snakes and so forth and so on. All that is called nature study, but nature study was within our constitutional right. So, and the park system, they do it pretty well, but they do it within their parks. It's not statewide. So the difference between the conservation department, we have statewide programs, and the park department did a good job, but they did it within the park program. So the idea of us moving into natural history was a natural. And the publications in that area were very poor for Missouri. And you will see what's happened in the last 25, 30 years. There's publications everywhere on almost every subject, and very well done, particularly the books on flowers and anything in the wild. We've got a good book on these days.
So today, unfortunately, we have a few politicians that would like to see this sales tax rescinded or taken away.
Well, sure.
What would you say to them?
Well, to just knock out the sales tax, you'd have to change the Constitution, because the Constitution says that that's within our purview. It's a part of the package. And it isn't just game animals or game fish or what, but it's the total natural world out there, pretty much. There's maybe no easy solution to that, but that's the way I would look at it. I can't imagine. We have a beautiful set of nature centers around the state. They're very popular. It takes care of a bunch of people that are city-bound, that do not have the open country feeling. They do not get out into the farmland, into the forest of Missouri, but they're city-bound. And it provides a large, you know, remember, a lot of our people in Missouri live in the cities, you know. And when you talk about quail hunting or whatever, you're not talking to these people. You've got to have a subject matter, and your subject matter is the natural world, which makes you a naturalist. That's what it does. And then we now have the Master Naturalist programs. I think we've got a program. It's always going to be changing, but it's a program that meets the needs of the people, not just one segment of the people.
Over the years, you had some incredible people working for you. Who are a few of those that stand out in memory?
Well, to start with, they pretty much trusted me. But I came on board, they said, we're not recruiting. Well, they didn't say that, but I said it. We're not recruiting right. We're not getting the right people into your work. So I started visiting universities, visiting people and so forth at the junior and senior levels in college and following those people. And when they became available, you could tap them and have them come in and do it. So out of that program came guys like Dave Erickson. I hate to start naming names, but
you have to. Yeah. You got to start naming names.
Well, Dale Humberg and Kenny Babcock and Dean Murphy, and I can go on and on and on and on. Glenn Chambers, perfect example. Glenn and I have extremely long arrangements. I essentially kept him from leaving Missouri. He had gone to work with me as a dove specialist, and he had really done a beautiful piece of work, and the feds noticed this. And so they offered him to be in charge of the mourning dove task force at Washington's Patuxent Refuge there in Washington. And they had made the appeal to him. So one day, Glenn said, Bill, you got to come over to my house. So I went over there, and here was his wife sitting here, and here was Glenn and me, and we sat there about 4 hours talking about should he move to Washington or should he stay with Missouri. He stayed with Missouri. So, and he never changed that attitude. He always, forever called me chief, and he and I traveled and did all kinds of things together. So he was a prime example of recruiting. You couldn't do that now. I don't think the social makeup of the way we do business anymore, I don't think we could recruit the same way quite. But I looked for the talent and found it and brought it to Missouri.
So you are almost alone in your unique perspective of the department from the day it was founded till today.
Yeah.
How are we doing today?
Well, one of the problems in anything you do, you tend to grow. When you grow, what are you doing? Well, you're trying to meet needs with the money of sales tax and so forth. We were able to do things that we were not doing before that met the public need. And so you put it back on that basis. In the proposition of growth, you begin to lose tact. I hate to use the word bureaucratic, but you tend to depersonalize the operation because you have more people to deal with. And if you're small, when I first started, we probably had half the staff we have now. But it was so easy. We were constantly on the phone. We didn't have resources to handle the public. So half these questions came right to the research, came right to us. And so everybody felt real close to our staff. Everybody knew everybody. It's not that way now because you've gotten bigger. We also, Missouri has a very mobile community. They come here and they leave here. I talk to my friends in California and Colorado. They say, hell, half the people out here from Missouri, I guess we're always leaving Missouri and never coming back. I don't know. But anyway, so Missourians are mobile. And so you got to be careful because, and then we've turned from an agrarian, from a farm economy to a city economy pretty much. And so that's changed. So if you don't stay on top of the changing population situation, the changing of society, you get lost. And today, there are so many organizations. I'm not complaining, but at the time the conservation came about, there weren't very many conservation organizations. Very, very few. Now, anybody who's got five people can get started and have a conservation organization. And they compete, and they have different attitudes about things. And you get the preservationists, and you get this people who don't want to shoot anything. You get this, and you want to get that. And you have the people who say your regulations are too tight, and we need to do this, we need to do that. You're always going to have this complaint. But as you get bigger, but you have to be sure you're open. And I think we try to, communication-wise, we really work at it. Our conservationists and all the publications we're involved in, people, we now hire people who can get up in front of people and talk and be accurate and say the right thing and do the right thing. We have an educated staff, and a lot of them don't stay around forever. And we usually have people that came on and stayed a lifetime. And that's the way everything is these days. People don't stay in one place very long.
Looking back at the challenges that the commission was facing in the early years, estimates say that we had 400 deer and 2,000 turkeys. Today, we have an estimate of 1.2, 1.3 million deer.
Oh, yeah.
We'll kill 50,000 turkeys a year in Missouri, number one in the country. So to be part of all that growth, to be part of the solutions that have led us to this wealth that we have today, that has to be a pretty amazing feeling.
Well, it is. And I guess we were Johnny at the rat hole. We were there at the right time. I don't know what would happen if we hadn't. We were a really early birds on this moving wild turkeys. We had a good stock, not too many of them, but we shared that stock with a lot of people. There are a lot of turkey flocks in this country that are Missouri flocks, you know. They really are. And, of course, they helped us. We tried to do more with the rough grouse, and we weren't quite the right habitat for that. But we have been very, very liberal in sharing our operation with other places. Missouri is a very unusual state, though. Listen to me on this. We are not south, and we're not north. I'm always in a problem with this. We go up to our friends in Wisconsin and Minnesota and so forth, and they say, oh, you guys, you don't talk the same as we do. You're southern. You know, I say, well, we're sitting in the middle. Then we go down south to Atlanta and Florida, and they say, oh, hell, you're just northern. So we are always sitting there in the middle. We were never quite on the same page as the Southerners or the Northerners. And they have social habits, all kinds of ways to hunt and fish and so forth. And they do it differently. And they think, well, you're different. Well, we're different to both sides. So here we are. We're kind of like the Civil War. We're a pretty strong Southern state, but we also were a Northern state. We're just exactly the same situation on all this other stuff. So, and I think Missouri always had such good talent and such good personnel that we made our point. It didn't get by.
I have my own formula. So not being a native Missourian, but now having been here nearly 8 years, I tell my friends that it's 50% Midwest, 25% West, and 25% Southern, where all the good things come together. So I was born and raised in Indiana, so I'm a Midwesterner by root. So I love the Midwestern appeal. I love the way people are here. I love, you feel bad in Howard County if you don't wave at every car that passes by. You miss one. I was doing something else.
That's where I came from.
I missed that wave, and I feel bad about it. Everybody waves at everybody, and there's just a genuine sense of goodness in Missouri. But yet, having lived in Montana for 4 years, I used to get lost on dirt roads and gravel roads out there. I can do that in Missouri. I can get lost on dirt roads and gravel roads in this state. And then there is that somewhat Southern hospitality as well. There's a sense of a Southern...
We're a mixed breed. We really are.
It's beautiful.
And I married a gal from Decatur, Illinois. The family used to say, well, we shipped all the people we didn't like to Missouri. And you say, you just got a bunch of robbers and bad people out there. Boy, that really set me afire, you know. But and I said, okay, enough of that. But it's been a very interesting life professionally because it always seemed like we weren't quite like anybody else. Of course, we got seven states right around us. The populations are different. And it's the geographic location with all the big rivers and so forth and the Ozark streams and all this good stuff happening. It's just, I spent the first 2 years of my life on the banks at the base of Taneycomo Dam. My dad was the county superintendent at Forsyth, and we sat next to Branson. We hardly knew Branson existed.
It wasn't what it is today.
No, it sure was.
No big Ferris wheel.
And now people don't know where Forsyth is, but it's county seat.
Oh, I've been there. There's some good striper fishing.
Yeah, and we had a big White House that was owned by the Ford Agency for Automobiles. They owned a big house right down there on the creek. I forget the name. It's famous creek right through town there. I got pictures of me when I was 1 and 2 years old sitting on a basketball in the front yard. But anyway, so my dad moved from the southern Missouri up to Mobley and was there 30, 40 years. And he was a gleam of bright light for me because he was a part of the radio period when everybody had one tube radios and that kind of stuff. And he was a PhD geographer. So I came with good blood, and I hope I did something with it. I'm not sure.
Well, I think we all know the answer. So after your professional career, you've been very civically involved as well. I know you're a historian here in Columbia. You went on to found the Prairie Foundation.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Right after the war, the soldier boys came back, and they looked over. They were coming home, but things were really changing. We were coming from a horse to a tractor period. They had the machinery to get rid of prairies. Even North Missouri was not considered good dirt, but because it had a hard pan. Putnam soils had a hard pan. You go down 12 inches and you couldn't do much with it. But with all kinds of new equipment and new tractors and new this and new that, all this thing stuff became available with fertilizer. And so that put the prairies in great deal. So here's a state that had 15 million acres of prairie at one time that supported all the prairie biota and so forth and so on. And it was fading very quickly. I ran a prairie chicken route between Columbia and Kirksville one time right after the war. I counted 250 chickens in one day. And 5 years later, we couldn't hardly find them in some places. It just literally disappeared within a 10-year period there. So the Prairie Foundation was a bunch of people that was really concerned. The department wasn't doing much with it, and I don't know what we could have, but Charlie Schwartz had done a momentum study on them, and he was a schoolmate of mine. He did a momentum deal on Prairie. He identified it. In fact, his books, he said, we either got to get in there and work on it, do something, or we're going to lose them all completely. So out of that observation, I and Don Christen, he was the assignment for that problem, we started work on. And we quickly found out that the department, they had bought one little prairie, Taborville. Nice piece of land with a couple of 200 chickens on it. But that's all they did. They said they just didn't have the money to do it. So I said, well, Carl, can I talk to you? So we went down and had a head knocking on that. He said, well, what do you suggest? I said, we need a private organization. So he said, well, I'll give you all the support I can. And he did, very, very proud. So we got this idea of instilling a feeling about the prairies in Missouri. We'd always put almost all of our efforts into forestry. And there was hardly any money going for the open land part of the program. So we got started, and we now are still a small organization, but we've assumed between 4,000 and 5,000 acres of prairie chicken lands. Prairie chickens are having a very tough time, and I don't know whether we'll save them or not, but we have a prairie feeling in the state now. And the prairie feeling was essentially brought back by the Prairie Foundation. The Nature Conservancy have jumped into this, and they're a great organization. We love them, but their original thoughts, if you save 5 acres of a prairie, you saved it. Well, you don't do that. You've got to have a pretty big acreage, or it's dead dodo. You know, just don't do anything with it. So I think we were pretty important in changing their attitudes on some of that stuff. And so we have become a very, very, for a small organization, a very influential deal. We're welcome. They love us, and we do a lot of good stuff, and we work with them, and we do all sorts of things. And we've just been through I don't know just how we did, but I'm kind of emeritus now. I'm not out of it, but I'm still watching them, and I attend some meetings. But this last 4 years, we raised $4 million.
Yeah, you have to be really proud of that organization. They're a great, great partner for CFM, and Carol, she's so passionate. I'm just drawn to passionate people. And I've learned a lot about prairie from her and Frank Oberle and Rudy Raceline and just these.
And her husband, he's such a good one with natural areas. And I was involved in natural areas too. So I carried what happened to me. In addition to getting into wildlife management, I was from the start a naturalist, and I got very much involved in being a naturalist. I used to do that kind of stuff. So anyway, private organizations are there, and they are needed, and they need encouragement. Sometimes, I will be very frank with you, when we first started the Prairie Foundation, there were about 15 of us sitting around a table, and I said, well, we've called you guys together because we're starting to step on toes here. And I said, not step on toes, we're getting ready to do something. So we went around the table and asked them to comment about what they were doing for prairies. They went around, well, we talk about it. What are you doing? Well, not doing. I said, that one morning at the Memorial Union in 1967, told me that we weren't doing anything. And so I said, okay, are you going to fuss? Because we're going to do something. So out of that meeting came a resolution that we form a Prairie Foundation. And later that fall in Columbia, we formed the Prairie Foundation with us officers and so forth and so on. And it took off from there. It'll never be a large organization, but it'll be an organization of people committed and very into it.
I want to ask you about a couple people who have preceded me as the director of CFM, starting with Charlie Callison. His book, Man and Wildlife in Missouri, is one of the great books I've ever read on wildlife.
Well, again, this gets back to my early statement. The Conservation Department was very fortunate in its early days to brought in a bunch of really competent people who had already made it before they got there. Charlie Kelson was a newspaper writer and all that good stuff. He was very smart, and we hired him as our communications guy. And Jim Keefe was a journalist, and we brought him on board. And if you really want to know a good story about early days, read his 51 book on the history of the department. It's excellent.
The first 50 years. The book, The First 50 Years. Yeah, that's great.
Super. But we were able to hire people that had a background. And of course, Charlie Callison was a great thinker, and he got big time, and he went head of the Audubon Society. They said they've never had a president like Charlie Callison at the national level for Audubon.
And communication was kind of at the root of his abilities.
So the journalist, we had a lucky turn that we got some of these good journalists in our direction, and that became a theme for them, and then they worked for us, and which was very, very helpful.
And then, of course, Ed Stegner, who held the job for 40 years. Did you interact with Ed much?
Oh, my goodness. you can't believe how close I was to him. Of course, he had that farm over in south of Boonville, you know. Ed, the day he graduated, now he was just a little picky. He was just a little chicken then. He came to my office. He said, "Well, I've graduated." And he said, "I think I'd like to go into conservation." I said, "What do you do?" "Well, I belong to a conservation club. I do this and I do that." And then, of course, he regularly showed up at our office about once a week, just running up down the hall, talking to everybody, getting up on the news and so forth. We felt very close. He was an argumentative son. You wanted to argue. I used to have some great arguments. I'd pick Charlie Schwartz, Ed Stegner, and Jack Stanford, who was in charge of Quail, me and a couple of other guys. You would get these sessions going, and they'd go all day long. And we'd almost kill each other. It was almost fun. But Ed was one of those guys here, but he would change. He was one of those that voted that day not to have a Prairie Foundation. He thought it would compete with his membership and would steal people from what he was doing, what we were doing. And later on, he became a board member. So that's the way that happened. So Ed Stegner he loved to get out and talk with people, and he had a great personality. He knew how to fight the legislative process, but it wasn't easy going. But he found friends and found the right people sometimes. Sometimes he didn't find the right people, you know. But he was really good for us. Ed was. And, of course, we've had other people since. And we got a new little guy here from all places, and he's making his mark, so what the heck. Wow.
So I knew this was going to go over an hour, but we're encroaching on an hour and a half. So everybody said you can't interview Bill Crawford in an hour.
Well, I'm not particularly proud of that. I guess I'm calling mouthy, you know.
I would say knowledgeable is the right word.
But I am a very fortunate person. I've had good health. I've had an enormous number of experiences over time, and I've been able to recall these. And I'm so happy to share them with people. I've had the Wildlife Society sent a bunch out from Washington. They did the same thing. I did this with the State Historical Society, and they're all different. It seems like you get off on different directions, you know. And I like to talk about things that I know something about. It's kind of nice to have a guy around who was there.
It is.
We're not many of us left, you know.
I pretend that I'm doing this for other people, but this is, I just want to know this.
Well, I want to tell you, I think I'm really proud of the Federation. I've always said, and you know, you get criticized for constructive criticism. They think you're against you. Constructive criticism is probably the best thing you can get, if you can take it. If you can take it. So I think what you're doing, you're expanding on your potential. That's what you're doing right now.
Well, I appreciate that. So the cool thing about these podcasts, and as you said, the historical societies and such as they archive these. So people can listen to these 100 years from now.
Yeah, and we're at a terrible, really not a very good period. The cell phone and all that, so much stuff is not being recorded. And I think more of the oral history stuff, you got to be careful in oral history, though, because you may say something different from the last time you said something, you know. But I think we're losing a lot by not having written stuff, letters and stuff to as actual proof. My wife was a tremendous genealogist. She wrote four big 400-page books on our families. We were all good old, we were good old European guys that liked to fight, you know, the Scotland boys. We were part of that deal. But she did all that without a computer. And amazing stuff that we dug up. And I traveled with her quite a bit on that stuff. And nowadays, everybody just punches deal and gets all this stuff without going there, you know, that kind of stuff. So
imagine for a moment that 100 years from now, you and I are long gone, and a student at the University of Missouri comes across this interview.
Yeah.
What do you hope the conservation world is like, the natural resources world is like in their era? And well, what do you hope they know about?
I don't know if it's true or not, but they say within the next 30 years we're going to double our population in the United States. That's going to be different. Yeah, but the United States has so much land that there's not going to be many people on. And so we're always going to have some wild country that's not suitable for people to live on. So we have that going. But we're having a hard time protecting the ones that we want to protect, you know. So industrial stuff, industrial this. I look at Texas. Texas, Houston is a perfect example. They have no zoning in Houston. You can do anything in the world you want to in the city of Houston, and nobody cares. And you go up to Dallas, and people say, what's there? Well, they have zoning, and it's a much better organized city than Houston is, just because there's restrictions. But I'm not for restrictions necessarily, but conservation puts a situation in place where you have a reason. You can explain why you're doing things, but you can't do it if you're getting it to the barbershop. You just can't do it. Go down and have a haircut and then come out and say, I'm going to take care of the deer herd today. You're not going to get it done.
Well, I can tell you something I'm stressing out about already. Is how we're going to fit everybody into the Tiger Hotel next year for your 100th birthday party. You know, there's probably only going to be room there for a couple hundred people. So it's going to be, that is going to be a party. We need to start planning that now. Yeah. So.
Well, I tell you what, over the years, I'm not a drinker, but once in a while, I know what to do with a bottle of scotch, so I'll be able to bring a bottle of scotch with you.
I will bring you a bottle of scotch. Bill, thank you so much for sharing some of your memories with us.
It's been fun. I really appreciate the opportunity. You get the opportunity to talk, but sometimes you don't talk with the people that are important. And I think your mission here with the Federation is so good. It's so good. Some states just don't have it. And I just, I think Missouri has done an excellent job along this line. I hope the people stay with us, and the people are changing too. So full speed ahead.